Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And Jacques Steinberg is here for one final installment in his WNYC schoolbook.org series on applying to college. He is a senior vice president of SayYesToEducation.org, a nonprofit that helps low-income students in urban communities apply to college and pay for it. And he's the author of The Gatekeepers, Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College. Folks, if you worked hard in high school, followed his advice, and had a little luck, you now have the problem here at the end of April of deciding which college to attend next fall among the ones that offered you a spot. Acceptance letters are out, and May 1st is the traditional deadline to commit and send a deposit check. And Jacques Steinberg shares his insight now in navigating this step. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brian.
And listeners, are you in the middle of this right now? Call us with your questions for Jacques Steinberg, or if you've already been through this and want to share some advice or wish you had done things differently, share it at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And one strategy that you write about that some families have adopted to give themselves more time to work out the financial aid or the wait list is to double deposit, meaning they send in deposits by May 1st to more than one school. How much are these deposits?
You know, if they are in the vein of a few hundred dollars, and if that's something that's not going to do an undue hardship for a family, it can buy you a little bit of time. It can also help you hedge your bets if your child has put themselves or has found themselves on a wait list at another institution.
And from what I've read, colleges consider this cheating. They hate this. Listeners, have you double deposited? That's one thing you can call up about. 212-433-9692. I guess colleges could fight back by raising the amount of the required deposit and making it financially prohibitive to raise your to hedge your bets like this.
I want to make clear that it's not a strategy that I'm advocating. I think that in most instances, in the overwhelming number of instances, look at the May 1st as a deadline. Try not to procrastinate that decision.
But why not? I mean, you know, this isn't going to be the only thing we talk about. But why shouldn't a family hedge their bets, especially if financial aid is not worked out? And you have to tell them before they tell you what they're going to give you to help you get your child through college, really?
Yeah, I think that it's you know, these cases become very personal, and but I would hate for a family that's using that strategy just to procrastinate trying to make that final choice when they do have all the information that they are going to have.
What advice do you offer parents and students when deciding between, say, a relatively affordable in-state public institution versus a name private school where you might wind up friends with future CEOs or something?
Look, these, again, are very, very personal decisions. And this may be the first time in your life as a parent, as a family, that you've discussed finances with your child. And I think there needs to be a clear-eyed, honest conversation about, for example, what amount of debt will be there at graduation to pursue that name brand education, and what is the strategy for paying off that debt? What sort of a burden is it going to be? And there's always, and if the calculation is that that elite private is out of range financially and will be a hardship, you know, there's always grad school, and ultimately it's what you make of it at what may well be a fine flagship public university or other public university.
And you write on schoolbook.org that you can push back a little with schools on their financial aid offers. Are they clear by this time, waiting for your May 1st acceptance? Does everybody know pretty much how much financial aid they are being offered?
Again, it's school by school, but in many instances, the offer is there. I write on Schoolbook, please don't treat these folks like salesmen at a car dealership that you're going to haggle with. But don't be afraid to say you don't understand something, particularly if the thing you don't understand is why a comparable institution is offering more aid. And do also push back if there has been a change in family circumstance.
And you say don't haggle like with a car dealer. But if you're accepted to University X and University Y, and University Y is giving you a ton more money but you'd really rather go to University X, doesn't it behoove you to say, you know, hey, look, I'd really rather go here, but it's financially prohibitive, and they offered me $15,000 a year. Can you come closer to that?
I think that that's absolutely appropriate. I think that it's important, if that's true, to share that information. Again, not in a way that says sort of beat this. Do you need to go in the back and see your manager? But just having a conversation as sort of human beings. Do also know, though, that there is a difference. There may be the difference may be because one institution offers merit aid that is tied to a student's academic performance, and the other institution only offers aid based on need. But very often, two institutions that offer need-based aid may come up with a different calculation. And there's certainly no harm in showing them the letter from the other institution and saying, we'd really rather come here. Can you do it?
Listeners, are you going through this decision-making process right now for yourself or your child with the May 1st deadline coming up? For this year's college admissions, have you gone through this in the past and have a story to tell that might help some of our listeners for this year or for the future, or a question to ask Jacques Steinberg, who's looked deeply into this? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Heather in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Heather.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I just wanted to add a little bit. I went through this decision well over a decade ago when I was looking at schools, choosing between a state school and choosing between a private school down in the South. And cost was was a big thing for me, because although I was given scholarships, the starting cost was very high, and now it's absolutely crazy. I just wanted to add that the state schools sometimes have wonderful networking opportunities with the alumni, things that a lot of people don't think about. If you go to Penn State, you have a guaranteed job when you come out of there, because the networking is amazing, and it's something that parents should think about.
Thank you very much. And I don't want to make guaranteed jobs sound like a literal guarantee, but the issue that I hear her to raise is, yeah, on the one hand, you want to send your child to a small elite school if you can, because it's small and they're going to get a lot of individual attention and the class sizes are probably capped and all of that stuff. On the other hand, if you go to a school with 50,000 students at any one time, look how big your network is when you graduate. Does that work?
I think I love Heather's point. I mean, if you go to Penn State and you are looking to work in-state in Pennsylvania, that is a tremendous loyal network. And I think as the costs of elite private educations for many families go up and up, you have to ask yourself, where is that value add, and whether that value you're looking for may be found elsewhere for a little more affordable price.
How about if you find yourself accepted by your safety school but waitlisted by your top pick, and you really want to go to your top pick and not to your safety school? What do you do on April 23rd?
Well, I think that it's extremely important that you convey to the school that has waitlisted you exactly what you said, that, boy, and if indeed this school is your first choice, and that's honest, let them know that in a letter, perhaps to the dean of admission or to the admissions officer who covers your region, and you can find out that information from the admissions office. And this really is the point in the process to wear your heart on your sleeve a little bit, to talk about what you know about the school, why you think you would be a great fit, and what you would bring to that school in terms of skills and academic achievements and spirit. And, you know, you don't want to go crazy and bake two dozen cookies or shower them with gifts, but a little ardor is not a bad thing.
How about showering them with any more evidence, like send in an extra recommendation letter, or I guess you're talking about almost an extra essay in this letter. But how about some other little piece of evidence, an article you got published, or something, you know, that for whatever reason you couldn't put into your original application?
I think it's a terrific point. I mean, you may have filed this application in December, and in the process you've won an award or you have another grade. You should absolutely update them on you in terms of milestones and academic achievement.
Janine in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment. I was a high school guidance counselor for many years and retired and now doing private work. And it's unethical to double deposit.
Why?
Well, first of all, NACAC has said that that is something that they do not support, and that's the National Association of College Admissions Counselors. And the reason that you don't want to do that is you're given a brief period of time to make your decisions. You have all the information that you need to have. Schools base their yield and who is going to come off a wait list or not come off a wait list based on these things. You can stay active on a wait list, and but you're still told to deposit to one school. And then if you're lucky enough to come off the wait list of a school you want to go to, then you rescind your acceptance to that other school and take your waitlist school, but you're not supposed to double deposit to two schools that have accepted
you. And I guess if you're on the waitlist, you're not being invited to deposit anyway. So it would be under other circumstances. But Janine, what about the waitlists? Because I have some stats in front of me, like Dartmouth waitlists 1,000 students. They accept 1,000 students per freshman class, and they waitlist 1,000 students. Boston University, 5,000 students. I don't know the size of their admitted freshman class. I'm guessing it's about that. So if there's a one-to-one ratio between the number of students and the number who they waitlist, why do they waitlist so many multiples of the numbers of students who can ever come off that waitlist?
Well, this is in the best interest of the college and not the best interest of the students. And I think that one of the things that you want to happen between April 1st and May 1st is to help the student, help your child feel good about his or her actual acceptances and make the best one choice to send in your deposit and agree to go to that school. The truth is that students could be happy at so many different schools, and even though they sometimes have their heart set on a school, once they get to some of these other schools that they applied to, so they must have been an interest, they need to make it their best choice. And I think it's hard when schools waitlist so many of these kids. The thing is when they defer kids, that kids apply early decision, most of the schools tell you that the deferral, most of those kids have no chance of getting in.
Yeah. Why do they double deposit these families when they do? If it's not for waitlist and the financial aid you're saying is made clear by the time they're offered a spot in the class, why do families double deposit? Do you know?
Well, they're not supposed to, but if they do, it really is because they haven't made the decision yet. And they have an agreement that they're supposed to make their decision by May 1st.
Right.
That's part of this whole process. And
Janine,
I think
do colleges, in your experience, really make their financial aid offers clear by May 1st in almost all cases?
They usually make their financial aid clear by April 1st.
Mm-hmm.
What your guest said is absolutely true. You have a month and you can go to a school and say, you know, as long as you do it appropriately, this is where we really would like to go. We didn't get as big a, an economic package, a financial package as we would like. And we were hoping you could do something about it. I've seen schools come up with the money. But you have to be prepared if they say this is the most we're going to give you make your decision.
Right. Janine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think Janine makes an important point that the waiting list is often more about the college than it is about the family. But the waiting list, when things shake out on May 1st and they know that they have 1,000 seats in the class and 950 kids have deposited, so now they have 50 slots to play with, they're going to look at that class and see what is it they need in terms of skills and backgrounds. Maybe they didn't get enough English majors.
But Chuck, according to the New York Times last year, of those 5,000 waitlisted students at BU the year before, 67 wound up getting in. 67 people out of 5,000. At Dartmouth, 40 out of 1,000. At Johns Hopkins, 25 admitted out of a 2,000 wait list. What?
It's again, it's about the college. But I will tell you this, that when they admit off that waiting list, if they even can admit off the waiting list, they want to make sure that the student they admit is going to want to come. They want to have 100% yield. That's why that letter saying, if you pick me, I'll come, yeah, is really important.
Do they tell you where you are on the waiting list?
I don't. They certainly wouldn't. And also, there is no way to rank a waiting list because they have to see what it is they need as far as they define need in the class.
Diversity and so forth.
All kinds of factors that come into how they assemble their class.
Lori in Maple, but not anymore at the University of Michigan. Lori in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for this important show. A couple of years ago, 2 years ago, my son is now a sophomore, we went through this process. And I just wanted to share some things that happened to us. He got into his first choice IV, or what he thought was his first choice, as well as a great Midwestern school, and we could not get financial aid from the Ivy. So he chose the school with Wash U, which is a wonderful school, and they gave him a nice package. And then he let another Ivy that he really wanted to go to know that he was on the wait list, and he wrote a note to them, and he was taken off the wait list. That day, I called financial aid and said, I'd like to make a face-to-face appointment because I was worried that, we had the same reaction as the first one. And it made a huge difference. I brought them a letter from the other school and was just really honest and said, as you were saying before, these are human beings. They're not salespeople. We're not salespeople. We really hope that we can make this work. This is where he wants to be. And it turned out that it was the best place for him. Huh. He did go there. And I had read something very interesting. I think it was a former president of Yale that said, you need to really, really look at why the schools who chose you chose you.
And Lori, I'm so sorry to leave it there, but we are flat out of time. But that's a wonderful success story. And I think the tone that you brought to it, people can really learn from, too. So I'm glad you got the last word today. Jacques Steinberg has been doing this series with us. He's the author of The Gatekeepers, Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College, and the president of SayYesToEducation.org. And you can read his latest piece on college application and admission advice on our education website, schoolbook.org. Jacques, thank you so much for this series.
Thank you, Brian.